The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, 2FM's Lottie Ryan and Fair City star Ryan Andrews will be appearing on the new series of Dancing with the Stars, and they join me in studio to talk about what we can expect when they hit the dance floor in January. Colin Wilkinson spoke to me about his amazing career, which has seen him play some of the greatest roles ever written for musical theatre. Clodagh Dunlop told me about being a prisoner in her own body and how she defied the odds to free herself from locked-in syndrome. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge talked to me about fame, Fleabag, and what fans can expect from her new book. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoy it. And at 9:29, 51551 is the text number, but we have much to discuss.
Dancing with the Stars on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, the music itself marks the beginning of something beautiful on the television calendar. Following much speculation, we can confirm live here on The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTÉ Radio 1 that 2FM entertainment presenter Lottie Ryan. And Fair City star Ryan Andrews.
Yay!
Are the next two celebrities to quick step their way onto Dancing with the Stars RTÉ 1 in the new year. Welcome, Ryan. Oh, welcome, Lottie.
Thank you very much.
Finally!
We can talk about it.
Lottie, how long have you been sitting on this secret?
Oh my God, this has been a couple of months of a secret, and I am not the best at secrets at the best of times. So to say that this is a weight off my shoulder, I'm sure that Ryan feels the exact same, because there's been about two people in my life that have known about this since like September, maybe?
You're married to one and the other one probably gave birth to you.
She did, yes. Okay.
Well, these are the important people in your life.
Absolutely.
And how does such a thing happen? Can you tell us about that? How do they decide?
Well, you get a phone call and they feel you out, and it's a process. And one that I have wanted to be a part of for a long time. Like, since this show first started, I've fallen in love with it. It just looks like so much fun. Yeah. And, you know, the idea of learning such an incredible craft and just being a part of it, it's such a beast. It's such a huge show. So when I found out that I had gotten it, I mean, I lost my mind.
So you're ready for this.
Oh, she's like, ready. She has her
so
ballroom
ready.
Shoes on and all. Look at them.
Ryan, tell us, you, of course, people would be familiar with more with you from probably from Fair City as much, and the Panto.
Yes.
Yes, they are. So you're obviously a very busy man at the moment.
Busy. So kind of today is, like, as Lottie was saying, it's just a release. We can finally talk about it. It's a weight off the shoulders. So I start Panto rehearsals at, like, in a half an hour till 4 o'clock.
Straight in.
And then first day of rehearsals, and also first day of Dancing with the Stars rehearsals as well today. So it's can't wait.
That's a tough gig. So how,
It's like a toy show.
My next question was, how old are you?
I'm actually getting very old now to say, so 26.
Oh, are you really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. Well, then you'll be well able for it. I'm just fine. I'm getting too old for this.
I was watching you on Friday getting tips off, you know.
Get tips off me if you want to learn something. But you're going to be... I mean, from your Panto experience, would suggest that you can dance?
A little bit. So it's one of them things.
Strictly come chancing.
There we go.
Okay.
Nice ring to it.
Yeah.
But this is a whole different ballgame. Completely. Like, as Lottie was saying, like, I've watched the show since, like, the last 15 years. Come Dancing with my mum and dad is their favourite show. So kind of grown up watching that. And even when Dancing with the Stars came to Ireland, I was like, oh, I'd love that. I would love to have an opportunity to kind of give it a go.
Sure.
Now I'm like, it's finally out. I'm starting sweating down my back now, thinking, what am I actually getting into? But yeah, I'll try my best. I'll give it everything I can, and we'll see how we kind of get on from that.
And are you handy on your feet? This is the important question.
A little, I think I can be, you know, a copper's at 3 a.m, that kind of thing, you know. So like, I'm first up on the dance floor and I'm kind of last to leave. So
okay, you're handy enough.
Look, I don't know.
You know,
maybe.
You know how to move. Lottie, you...
Listen, I clap in time when I'm at a concert.
That's it.
So that means I've got rhythm, I think.
Yeah.
I think, like, I went to performing arts school as a child, as many people do, but this is a completely different discipline. This is, like, technically ballroom, Latin. I have never done anything like this in my entire life. So I'm completely planking myself.
But the pros are training their whole lives. Like, we met all the pros. They're absolutely, like... incredible. Like, they're literally training since, like, they're born and world champions, and you're looking at them going, oh my God, the discipline that this kind of takes, like, is mind blown.
But the challenge, I think, is half the fun. I mean, I'm really looking forward to being out of my comfort zone and, you know, doing something that I'm just have no clue about. It's learning something new, and I feel like it's been a while.
And what are you most nervous about? What are you
that music? Even thinking about, I'm actually getting sick. Even thinking about that now, coming down them stairs for that first show, because it's like you can't train for this. There's nothing like Pantos or radio or whatever it is. This is a different thing altogether. So the first time we will do it is that Sunday,
and it's live, isn't it? So it's not make yuppie TV. It's proper.
It's all sinking in now, Ryan.
So how long have you known this secret?
Yeah, a couple of months now at this stage. Again. And it was that kind of thing where I got a phone call, and because I loved the show and a few people kind of knew that I loved it.
Yeah.
And I got a phone call. I was like, oh, you Dance with the Stars here. Yes.
Oh, really?
And then I was like, sorry, go on.
Oh,
like,
talk to my agent.
Yeah, yeah. And then they're like, so are you? Yes, yes. I just kept saying yes throughout the whole thing.
I cried.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did. I cried. I got the phone call when I was sitting in traffic on my way home from work. And like, I lost my mind. I was screaming and shouting. Then I cried. And I just looked over and there was somebody in a car. Because I was in rush hour traffic, and they were looking over going, are you okay?
Oh, will they be nice to you?
Yeah, I think they thought, Jesus, that poor girl. Something awful has happened to her.
Because I often wonder, like, if you see somebody crying in a car beside you, going, oh, God, what horror are they going through?
I know.
And I would have seen you if I didn't know you.
Although I gave a thumbs up. I was like, it's good news.
Good happy. It's not sad happy. How do you feel about being judged not only by the judges who are paid to judge, but say the creatures?
I don't, that's something that I've never really experienced before, so I'm not really too sure.
As in online and
online, kind of like with the acting, because that's obviously what I've been doing for like people, you know, on my talk about Fair City, good, bad, whatever it is, as a whole, but never as like an individual.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be a completely new, but just take it on board. This is something that I wanted to do, and whatever. My mum and dad, Davey, my girlfriend, like, they're happy about it, and that kind of all that matters, I think.
That's
really
okay.
And I think I'm saying that now.
Lottie?
I think I'm well used.
I called you Lotto there for a second. Then.
That's okay.
Lottie.
I think I'd be well used to turning a blind eye at inappropriate criticism. The criticism I only care about is the one the judges are going to be giving, to be honest with you. Constructive criticism, I am 110% down for.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's how you get better. It's how you learn. It's how you grow. But in terms of, I mean, like, do you mean it's kind of like a popularity contest?
Well, yeah. I mean, no, I just mean in terms of people being mean.
Yeah.
You know, I think online particularly.
I'm going to try and assume the best and hope that people won't be mean just for the sake of being mean. I'm hoping that people are learning that's not a nice place to be.
Yeah, but as you say, once you have the people around you that matter the most 100%. About getting it right. Have you been introduced to the dancers? Did you say you've met them?
Yes, yeah, so we met the contestants and met the dancers there kind of last week. So it's still all new. It's like the first day of school. Like, nerves. Like I would like talking, and I like meeting new people and all, but I didn't have dinner. We were talking about this. Me and Lottie were there just like not having dinner that day, just really anxious and nervous. It's like the first day of school all over again.
Really?
Oh, really? Yeah.
Have you been paired up with your dancers?
That's kind of today.
Yeah,
so we're kind
of... You've completely been paired up with the dancers, haven't you? Did you not allowed to say? That's it. Okay, got it. Without even saying it, you haven't even nodded or anything. I'm just getting a good sense.
That's really bad acting on my behalf, isn't it? Yeah, like the worst poker face ever. Yeah.
So you've been paired with the dancers. Who did you get, Lottie? No, I'm only joking. I was only testing it. We'll find out in due course. And we have, I mentioned Michael Caruth earlier on, of course. I didn't realise that was only speculation. So it could be somebody else entirely. It could be Katie Taylor. She's doing nothing these days.
Yeah.
And who
after
knows?
After the toy show. after the toy show appearance.
Oh, yeah. That moment.
That was amazing.
That moment.
Congratulations on the toy show as well.
She was, thank you. But it was lovely. That little girl
was
boxing.
Just
Ella, I think. Yeah,
Ella. That's exactly her name.
And when she said that she was going to give her the one-on-one lesson, my heart. Because the girl, literally, she caught her breath. You could see her like yeah, in yeah. complete disbelief. It was just wonderful.
And the little girl Sophie with the brother going to School of Rock. Like literally, I bawled my eyes out crying.
There were a lot of tears that seems on Friday, but
happy tears.
I think it was happy tears for them and the kindness of
the courage that they showed was inspiring.
Not easy thing to do. I think Sophia, who was being bullied, I mean, particularly brave, and I don't say that lightly because it's a word that gets bandied about, but to come out and say on TV, you know...
That is not easy.
I'm on the Toy Show. You're watching me. Who's the weirdo now?
Oh.
I love that.
Yeah. Even thinking about it now.
I nearly punched the air when I saw that again. Yeah.
I just think she was incredible. Like, breathtakingly brave. Yeah. Because I think, as an adult, I only recently spoke about being bullied in secondary school. And, like, I am a grown woman and I found it really difficult to do. Yeah. And I spoke about it with Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM, who's a friend. Mm. Like, she was in a strange environment. I'm not going to call you a strange man, but a man she doesn't know.
A stranger.
A strange man.
And she had the guts to do that.
I know, on live TV.
How amazing.
Yeah, it is true. But when you spoke out about it after all the years, did it feel in any way liberating that you shared the story, or was it strange for you to do that?
It was both. It was liberating in the sense that I wasn't expecting such a positive response and I wasn't expecting so many people to sympathise and empathise with me.
What happened to you when you were bullied?
Oh, like, it was really awful. It was in first year of secondary school and, like, I was eating my lunch in the toilets and it was a bad time. But I moved schools and was consequently very happy afterwards. But I think it shaped the person I am. And I think it had a long-term effect on me, probably.
And was it because of who your dad was?
I think that definitely made me a target.
And was it?
I think that made it easy.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, I think he was, I don't even remember what he was doing. It was a television show. I think he could have been doing Let Me Entertain You or something. Yeah. But anyway, he was on the sides of buses, his face and stuff. And this had never been an issue for me before. Yeah. Because I grew up in a lovely bubble of ignorance. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it was a thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't get that it was a thing. And life was quite difficult for a while. But, you know, I got through it and I had a fabulous family support. And that's why when I was watching her on The Late Late Show, I just thought, my God, if she's able to deal with this as opposed to me, a grown woman, think of the things she can accomplish and the people that she can help in her lifetime. Yeah.
And I got so many messages over the weekend from people saying, my daughter turned to me and said, God, I'm like
Isn't
her.
That amazing?
And then of other people closer to your age, Ryan, who would have said, that was my story. You know, how something so innocent on the face of it is actually quite profound and totally resonant for a lot of people. Yeah. It is. You're a dad. Is that what you said? Did you say you have a child?
No.
Oh, I thought for a minute you said...
My dad.
Oh, your dad.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, Jesus, there we go.
Congratulations.
Shock revelation there now. Yeah, yeah.
Dancing with the Crib. a whole new show.
Yeah.
I thought you said that for a minute ago. But your dad was involved in... what was he? Tell me a bit
about it. So my dad is actually... he was a footballer kind of growing out up his whole kind of life. And that's kind of what he was. And he works in Guinness's. Yeah. So he works with machinery and all. Like something. And my mom, like, so nobody in my whole entire family were involved in any of this. Yeah. Kind of industry, like, you know, it was how I kind of got started was it was an ad in the paper.
Wow.
It was for Singing in the Rain. It was like I played like the young Gene Kelly, like, you know, I had a few little lines like the Don Lockwood character.
Yeah,
ad in the paper. And I
said, so when you heard do 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 do, do you kind of go not again,
smiling,
you love it,
smiling,
it's a happy memory.
Yeah, happy memories.
It's a lovely song, isn't it? Singing in the Rain,
like, and the Good Morning as well. So like, that would have been a thing of like I had 30 seconds in the whole show. Literally, I walked on, I was like, waved, and then I sat in the wings every show for like 5 weeks just watching and going, wow, that's deadly. This is what I want to do. And then kind of went in and kind of did it. And then the clinic, I was in the clinic for a couple of seasons, the RT program as a child, and then kind of grew up into that. And then Fair City kind of kicked off. So then the acting then for the last 10 years is where... And Pantos is kind of where
and
I
Pantos.
Came.
So Sean Cassidy on Fair City.
Yes.
And then Panto, do you have the same character?
Ollie.
Ollie and, yeah, and the Panto all the time.
It's Polly and Ollie, kind of a double act. And Ollie, Ollie, Ollie. Oi, oi, oi. Yes, Lottie. We didn't rehearse that beforehand. So it's kind of, it's all good. And this is a thing as well that it's something new. It's like a fresh kind of start. Me and Lottie were only talking about it. Be like, wow.
My favourite is the Charleston.
Yeah.
I love when they do the Charleston, because especially when they put it to different, you know, modern music as well.
Why
as
do you love the Charleston?
It's
a bit goofy.
Yes. How did you know? But it's it's kind of crazy as well. Isn't it?
I know. Yeah.
And the legs are going left and right. I think it's kind of.
They're
going
to book you for next year now.
No.
Yes, they are
unavailable. Ever. But I will watch. It's just something really warm about the show.
Oh.
On a Sunday, it's nice, it's family, everyone gather around and have a good laugh.
It's just feel good television. Feel good. Glitz, there's sequence, it's people.
There's spray tans.
How do you feel about that, Ryan?
Well, basically,
half his body is spray tan. Half.
Well, not now. It's not now.
Yeah.
It was last week. Literally, I thought spray tans will be for January, you know, kind of February for the shows. Oh, no, there you go, full on. And you know,
was it your first spray tan?
Yes, and
how was it for you?
Cold and very. I didn't know that you spray tan your face.
Oh,
so did you know that?
Of course, I didn't know that.
Yeah, exactly. So next of all of a sudden, like, okay, close your eyes. Whoa, close my eyes. Shh. I was like, okay, went out.
What about the smell?
Smell actually wasn't too bad. It was the stickiness, and then with the awkward moment, like the sheets, like my mom, I still live at home, was cleaning, like, you know, the sheets full of spray tan and tan. Ah. So my aunties are all going over. Oh, Jesus, Jackie, you know, what were you using? I'm like, it was mine, you know, I couldn't say it. It was the most awkward moment of my life. Yeah.
Spray tan and sheets. There's a whole chapter in the book of anthropology about that, I'm sure, you know.
I don't know how you do it.
That can be the name of your bio, spray tan and sheets.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that an autobiography? Yeah. I love
the face in the pillowcase, and you've got the shrouded terrain looking at you the next day. You know what I mean? You've got to talk about miracles.
It's just
pretty vital. But I mean, you're going to embrace the dresses.
Say dresses, and then they hand you what appears to be a swimsuit covered in sequins.
Oh, is that what it is, really?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, listen.
And that's just Ryan.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Just Ryan's outfit. The costumes are, honestly, probably one of my favourite parts of the show. I come from, my granny was a costumier,
yes,
so costumes are, my home was just full of costumes growing up. I adore them. And the sequins, the glitter, the whole razzmatazz of the show, it just excites me so much.
I'm excited by your excitement. I think it's going to be great. They're lucky to have you both. It's going to be wild.
Much.
I think you're going to have great fun. I think they've chosen really well to have you both. So go forth and have the crack, won't you both?
Thank you so much, Ryan Andrews.
Love to the family, Lottie, as always. And Ryan, best to your folks. And thanks for coming in to see us today. You're busy. So when does the Panto finish?
So the Panto finishes in the Olympia on the 4th of January, Saturday, and then the live show is then on the 5th. So it's kind of, I'm literally looking at the clock going, right, grand, straight rehearsals for 10, hit the ground running. But that's feast or a famine, take it and go.
Take it and keep dining. Yeah. And the same with you, Lottie. Thanks, Amelia, for coming in to see
us today. Thanks for having us.
Have fun. I just want to play a little bit of it again.
Dancing
on RTE
Radio 1, sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
My guest this morning has played not one but two of the greatest roles ever written for musical theatre. First as Jean Valjean in Les Mis, and later in Phantom of the Opera as, of course, the Phantom. Colm Wilkinson, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
It's always good to see you, Colm. How's life?
Amazingly average, actually.
Is that right? You need to get out more and have some crack. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's
let's talk about all of your comings and goings, because I think what I'd start at the beginning in some ways, 10 of you.
Oh, you're going back. Marriage
I'm going back
Road.
That far. Yeah.
Road, yeah.
10 of you in the house.
Yeah.
In Drina.
12 with the,
the
mum and dad, yeah.
And your mother doing what?
Trying to look after us, I suppose. Trying to make it. Trying to make ends meet. No, we were okay, actually. The old mama had a fairly decent job. But there was a lot of us in that small house. We had to move. Unfortunately, we had to move in when I was 10, 11. Hated leaving Mangerton Road.
Did you?
Great place to grow up in. Oh, yeah. The valley and the green. No, that wasn't before it was an industrial estate.
Yeah.
And community spirit, the people, the whole thing was wonderful, yeah.
And your mother was into the amateur dramatics, wasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, down across Malina where she was born. She was sort of amateur dramatic time, yeah. Yeah. And singing, played violin, played a mouth organ a little bit as well.
Did she?
Very musical, very, very musical, yeah.
Yeah, your father had a few musical instruments going too, did he?
Yeah, a mandolin, eventually a banjo, a tenor banjo. Used to strum away. I don't know where he got that from. He did do that, yeah.
How did your mother find time to...
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
To get the instruments going, if she had 10
she
of you.
She played very little violin. Fiddle to him, maybe. No, I just remember her showing me the violin one time after we moved down to Grove Park. She was educated at Girton Abbey outside Cross Malina, and the nuns taught her how to play violin and et cetera, et cetera. And she sort of, it was sort of a finishing school as such. So she was well into opera and that kind of stuff, you know.
Now, you obviously went to the States quite young, didn't you? You were
15.
15 years old. How did you fly to the States at 15 years old?
I went with a band called the Chris Lamb Band. We flew all right. No doubt about that. First time I was ever in a plane was straight out of Dublin, straight into New York.
Like at 15 is pretty big.
15 or 16. I may have celebrated my 16th birthday while I was in the States. Yeah.
And when you, like from going from Drimnagh to New York at that age.
No, I went to Grove Park first, Ryan. I went from 11 into Grove Park about 12 and at 15, yeah, left 15, 16, left Grove Park for New York. Yeah.
Well, I'll never forget landing.
Culture shock.
That's what I was going to say.
Total culture
shock. Seeing New York for the first time is...
Oh, well, I mean, at my age, I mean, that's 60 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, to see those big, long gas guzzlers and all these sort of cars, all the traffic and the hubbub and the... Yeah. The noise. It was an amazingly exciting city at the time.
When did you, Colin, when did you realise that you were, your voice was going to get you places? How old were you?
I don't know.
Were you 5? Were you 15? Were you 25? Like, when did it become a serious...
I was standing outside the Federation when I was 14 years of age with a guitar, waiting to get picked up with bands. I don't know what delusion I suffered under. I mean, when I think back on it, and it's only been recently I've been thinking back on these things, because we moved from Toronto, as you know, and I've been going through the attic and going through the old stuff and thinking of the career and the not looking at it purposely, just the way the stuff was happening, the way I was looking through the stuff that we had to take back and the whole sort of arc of what we did and where we came from and what we did in our lives, Deirdre and I. Was all there in front of me, and I was just saying, geez, I mean, it was just work to us, as I told you before. But then I began to realize this is a bit of a journey, all right, with all the people we met and all the places we've been.
Yeah.
I arrived, I don't know, I really had a passion for it. I really liked doing it, I suppose. I don't know. It's maybe just showing off. I don't know.
Well, everyone has a microphone in front of them and likes it as a show off in some ways.
Oh, absolutely. Total. But I used to practice up in my bedroom a lot, very shy, perform with, when I did these things, I used to do intervals for a band called Vic Mellows.
Yeah.
And I would sing when they were having their cups of tea or something at the intermission, myself and my mate. We'd get up and I'd play, do Come On Everybody, the Eddie Cochran thing, and with my back to the audience. I was too shy to look at the audience. I'd freak if I looked at the audience.
Have you still got that
pre-show
nerves?
Yeah, total.
Still?
Total nerve head.
Never conquered them?
No, and opening night's the worst nightmare of all time, getting through anything. That's the way I am. I'm just a nervous performer. I just... happened to go through hell getting there. I enjoy the process. I enjoy getting there and singing, and I have great passion for singing. But getting to that stage, I say to the kids all the time, nerves are normal.
Nerves are normal. And is that regardless?
Not as bad as me, but they are normal.
No, but they are. I often say it to guests who are nervous before a show. I said, look, I'm nervous. You should be nervous. It's weird not to be. But to have them after, I suppose, all these years, given what you do, does it matter what size crowd? Is it just the idea of getting on a stage regardless of size?
It's fear of failure. It's fear of failure. It's fear of not being... And I over-practice. I over... You know, people say I'm a perfectionist. I'm not. I'm a progressionist. I just keep on working and working and I think, so when the red light goes on, I know something will come out.
You're not a perfectionist, you're a what?
I'm a progressionist. I like to get things to where I feel is comfortable for me.
Yeah.
That might be way ahead of what other people think. You're a total lunatic. But I like to get things to where I feel comfortable that I'll be able to do it.
I'd love, I mean, Deirdre's sitting outside and on another day I'd ask her to come in, but I'd never put her on the spot. I'd love to ask her through the window, is he impossible to live with? I mean, I know you love him and all, but it's what she's saying. We'll find out in a second. But do you think you'd be...
I probably am.
I was going to say, are you a tough egg to live with now? No, she says you're a joy to live with. Okay, thank you. Joy to the world.
Deirdre is an amazing woman. I mean, that's 50% of it right there, maybe more, 60, 70% of it there.
That much?
That backup. You need that. You need somebody to tell you, you're doing okay. Yeah, you'll be fine. I'm always self-doubt.
Since
do you not suffer? Of course, you're super confident. You're super.
Don't take that tone, Colm.
Hold on a sec. Congratulations on the Gay Byrne thing. That was a wonderful tribute you did to him, and also the toy show. Man, I had to go back out of the room about 5 or 6 times just to lie down, watching you leaping around like a demented druid. I don't know where you get that energy from, but I'll say one thing, Ryan. Yeah. I have never seen trust. Children trust people or trust a person like the way they trust you on that.
Thank you.
Very seldom you see that nowadays, because all this thing of looking at kids and all this thing of interacting with kids, mm-hmm. it's sort of a bit taboo now.
It is.
It's a bit creepy.
Yeah.
You have this amazing sort of affinity with children. It's absolutely magic to watch.
I always wanted to be a dad and then I became one. And then my girls got kind of older, so now I have these other children.
But apart from that, these are kids that you just bring in from different, and they all trust you implicitly.
Yeah, that's nice.
That was wonderful. That was wonderful to watch.
But anyway, thanks for saying that. And the point
not
is
at
that
all.
They,
well deserved.
They have great confidence themselves then, because they'll tell their stories.
But you give them the confidence.
Well, thanks
you
very
give
much.
Them the confidence.
I was just once saying about Deirdre, though. I just want to talk about her, because I love the fact that I've met you down
through
the years.
You love Deirdre.
Kind of love what she does for you. Yeah, I love what you do for each other. I've met you on and off down through the years. And you're probably the only singer, artist, shall we say, who I've never met you without Deirdre by your side. I think Brendan Grace was a bit like that too with Eileen. Oh, she does. No, but I just think it's very, very, I think it's romantic. I think it's supportive. I think it's kind. I think it's... You're 50 years married next year. Congratulations.
Well, Deirdre's dad was a musician. Mm. Deirdre's dad was a musician. He was a trumpet player originally, a band leader. He worked in the Royal. And that's where Deirdre's mom and dad met. And then he worked for RTE, became a conductor, arranger in RTE. For me, growing up, I don't know whether I should rap on too much about this, it was always a hobby. Was looked upon by my family as a hobby. He's playing a guitar, he's going out to America, and it was always, when is he going to get a real bloody job? It was all that kind of vibe. I went down to Deirdre's home, and for the first time I saw a musician, a fully professional musician with a loving family, and I thought, you know what? People can do this.
Yeah.
And they can do that. Now, I wasn't at Bobby's standard, but they can do this. So that was a plus for me, great confidence builder for me.
Just reading about you just before this interview, I got the impression your dad and yourself had a pretty, was it tricky?
No, tricky, very tricky. Yeah.
Did he come to see you when you started in the big, like Jesus Christ Superstar?
He came to see me on my last night.
What?
I don't know what his problem was. Yeah. I don't know whether he wasn't, he was always, when is that guy going to get a decent job? I think the first time he really thought when Les Mis hit. And I signed a book because Trevor Nunn asked me, he said, when you're kneeling down to pray in Les Miserables, you got to think. I said, what's the thought process there? He said, well, think of somebody, holy, like, the Pope or whatever. And I said, yeah, okay. The thing that came into my head was my old man. He was a sort of a sick Catholic. When he was in trouble, he would pray. So he was down on the knees praying. And that's the thing that struck me to use in the scene of. So I wrote a little thing on a book. I didn't get on well with him. I didn't talk to much to him because we didn't have much in common. And I said that inspired me, that the moment I saw you praying in the front room. You must have been in really dire, because they were downstairs, because all of the rooms upstairs were filled with the kids. And he used to go around them with a book under his arm saying, do you see this? This is my son, you know. That was the first time when Les Miserables hit that he sort of acknowledged that I was...
How old were you at that point?
I think it was in... Well, I think it was in my early 40s when I actually got Les Mis, yeah.
Kind of took him a while to come round to...
Well,
your...
it took him a while. I've been in... Look, don't ask me why. I've no idea. P.V. Doyle was a great friend of his.
Hotelier.
And he said, you've got to... You know your son has been in the West End playing Judas for the last 3 years. Have you seen him yet? And he said, no, or something like that. And he said, you've got to go and see your son, you know. He wasn't that interested. I don't know what the deal was. I really don't know.
He mustn't have considered it a real job. Was he saying that to you? Like John Lennon's Auntie Mimi.
Oh, that was the bit, yeah. When is he going to get a real job? He's worried about supporting kids and this kind of thing. But when I suddenly he realised this was a long gig and this was a hit show or whatever, like Superstar was running on and on and on. No understanding of it.
Did you have peace in the valley with your father when he died?
Sort of, to a certain degree. There was my mom and dad split then, the marriage broke and split, and there was a lot of animosity going on between. I took my mom's side in this, so that was another wedge.
Another chapter.
Yeah, it was another chapter, yeah.
Okay. Mm. I want to hear a bit of your singing, Bring Him Home, and the reason I'm doing it is because you own it. Mm. No one will be able
to... Well, I owned it 30 years ago.
You still own it 30 years later. No one will be able to sing the song.
It's just, yeah, just I wonder.
Just a piece of it. You wonder?
Mm.
Stop that.
You can take, you can give, let him be.
No one can do that. You're gassy. You talked all the way through that.
I'm sorry, man.
No,
sorry,
because
I heard it before.
How do you feel about that song?
I feel very proud. I feel very proud that he wrote the song for me. And I feel very proud of other things that I did in the show that he rewrote around me. Because that show originally, by the way, a lot of people don't know, was written for a baritone. It wasn't written for a tenor. So when I got the part, start learning the part, this is too low. So I start jumping octaves.
Sure.
And that's when they start writing in all that stuff for a tenor and writing. I have to rewrite the whole show around his voice.
Yes.
So when he wrote that, there was V8s going in all over the place. But no, it's wonderful to have a song like that written for you. But that... When we got it, it was a different animal, you know.
I can imagine.
We sort of changed it.
But the singer and the songwriter, it was like it's like Burt Bacharach and Dionne Warwick. They just came together and said, "We got this," and you got together.
Well, he came back from Paris and he had it and he started off. He said, "I got this song. I got this song. I must play you the song. The song. The song. The song." And it was in the Barbican, and I said, oh, "Okay." He says, "I wrote this song," because they said Valjean has to have it. Are you, if we want to talk about this, Valjean has to have a song to sing in the barricades, but he said, oh, 24601, they're not big enough. No, he needs a song, prayer, something like, not a prayer, but he needs a song to sing over Marius, the sleeping Marius. And it was John Caird who said to Herb Kretzmer, I think this sounds like a prayer that triggered the lyric. Mm. And he came back then. I didn't have any lyric. All I had was Claude Michel Schoenberg down in this rehearsal room, and he dragged me down and he said, "The play with this melody, the melody." And you know that kind of vibe that the French go on. It was a Charles Hasnow voice job, you know. What do you think, old man? And he had pop records out, and somebody said, oh jeez. Anyway, I thought, oh, that's interesting. So it's gone, there's about two or three different sections to it. But he eventually wants to put the lyrics to it. I wanted to do it up, and it was in A. I wanted to do it in B because I felt it flowed it better, up a tone from what it was, but it was eventually ended.
And you spent how many years doing Phantom in Canada?
Spent four and a half.
4.5 years.
1,700 performances.
How many?
1,700.
And how many a week was that, roughly?
Like 7, 8. Yeah, the thing about it is, I, again, up in the attic in Canada, which is a lot to be...
That's where you keep the mirror. And not the paper now.
No, the attic in Canada. Yeah, the attic in Canada was, I reckon, 15 years in musical theatre, doing 7 to 8 shows a week.
Good Lord.
That was the culmination of the whole thing. That was the tot on that period of my life. I couldn't believe it. 15 years. And people say, yeah, well, that's probably where I earned my get lost money.
Let's have a listen.
Sing once again with me.
Compliment the it ain't necessarily so, that version you do on Stage Heroes,
cool,
your gorgeous
cool,
album
yeah.
I got recently. The Rolling Stone magazine voted you one of the five best singers in the world, and obviously Les Mis and Phantom were all part of that success. Can I ask you, why did you decide to come home to Ireland more recently?
Always wanted to be home, Ireland. We never really emigrated, Deirdre and I. We were always missing Ireland. Now, the places we were in were fabulous and they were great to us and we had a great lifestyle. It was just dragging the kids around on the coattails all the time. So that's why we eventually ended up in Toronto, as I told you before. I went in for 6 months and I stayed for 30 years.
Yeah.
But as I said, I've been on the road for 60 years and that last sit-down was the longest sit-down we've ever had in any city, 30 years. Prior to that, it was moving around. We'd been on the road since in the 50s, you know, from the 50s. But it was very successful, the show. The Phantom was very successful and they looked after us very well. The kids were going to school. They had a permanent sort of sit-down for that length of time. He sort of reared them, the basis of them in Toronto. So it was a good city. It was a safe city and a good educational system.
I hear great things about Canada. I've never been, but they were nice again, lucky to have you. Brian Nolan in Galway says, great to hear Colm Wilkinson again. First saw him in the early 70s in JC Superstar with Lochray Coral and Dramatic, where he stayed for a week.
Right, yeah,
made
yeah,
us all
yeah,
so proud yeah. to be with him there. Yeah. Second time was meeting him after a Les Mis performance in New York, where he graciously took time out to meet with us backstage. An amazing and totally humble Irish icon. Ryan says another. Fiona in Wicklow says, Colm Wilkinson is a true legend and a national treasure. He sounds like a beautiful person. He has the most amazing voice. We the Irish people are so proud of you, Colm. What a great artist he is. He will always be talked about in years to come. Well done, Colm, in all you have achieved. You strike me as the sort of person who doesn't realise how respected and appreciated you are. So I'm delighted you're getting this today. Is that fair to say, Deirdre? This is a yes, we're all happy about that. I've always had extreme anxiety and it has curtailed any chance of me becoming a performing artist. So I admire Colin for 40 years and bless him. Remembering in the 60s, Colin with the action in the Nevin, glass Nevin always greats his Eamon in Dublin 13. Pass on our affection to Colin and Deirdre from Lillian and Robert Chambers. Oh, well. Sure, I know Lillian and Robert, neighbours of ours. Colin introduced me to a love of musicals as a child, and 40 years later, he's still my favourite. He will be my ultimate Jean Valjean to me, and thank you for your beautiful music. And of course, Hugh Jackman was a big fan of yours when you filmed. You played the bishop in the movie,
yeah.
Handing the metaphorical torch the candlesticks to him in that film.
Yeah, he's nice, very nice guy, Hugh.
Big fan of yours. I just want to hear you sing a bit more. Hang on. And on goes the love. Do CT remember the song Amokaji and Lena Gokdina Gwiv? Let's rock. He sang it in school. And of course, you did. Didn't you do the Let's Make It Your Kind of Country?
Fianna Fáil. Fianna Fáil,
back in the day. That was a single that would have been in a few houses. You're going to be playing St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Yes.
December 21st.
Yes. I'll see you Pat there. Egan promoting it.
No better man for than that.
And it's
be gorgeous.
I think there's some tickets left, but not a lot.
Well, your voice in St. Patrick's Cathedral will be something to behold, so I'm going to see you there.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, do you think Falls in Prison Blues will be okay in St. Patrick's?
Yeah, even better. But then, sure, listen, if there's a
no,
there's,
no,
there's
no,
a
we're
going to
do
that.
We got the Irish choir with Veronica McCarron conducting, fabulous young guys. Girls. We got the O'Neill sisters and Rachel Coyne.
Oh, Rachel, yeah, she was
guys.
Yeah,
one of your proteges. And it should. The choir are great, and I'm doing two songs with them. I wrote a song called We Will Sing Now, and it's about mental health because I'm a bit close to that, and I like to get more awareness of that going out. And it's about darkness into light, that kind of thing that's happening in Ireland, and more awareness of that situation. So I wrote this song about that, and the choir are going to do it with me. Hopefully I remembered all the lyrics.
You will, of course. Yeah. Colin, it's been so good to see you, and to you and yours, happy Christmas. And
thank you very much, Ryan.
There's a
thank
song
you.
Close to your heart called Harcourt Street.
Oh, yeah. And I want to play Oh, God, I didn't get to Brian Byrne. Brian Byrne helped me out big time in this Harcourt Street.
No better man. He's a great composer.
Yeah. And I didn't... the Irish Youth Musical Theatre Society, Shamey Campbell, were starting this new impetus right across Ireland, north, inclusive of north and south. We're going to start a whole amateur musical society or musical organisation with the Royal Irish Academy of Music.
Great.
And we're going to encourage young kids to come in and learn. A lot of professional guys are getting on board. I'll be doing master classes and stuff like that.
What a great
I want to see young art. The bar here, Ryan, is so high. The bar is so high in terms of getting these young guys out and about. And I tell you, there's going to be some... I'm encouraging young writers to write musicals, to write music, because they're going to have a safe place to do it. And we will have great guys looking after them.
It's a beautiful thing to do, and keep us posted as to how it all goes.
Well, I will, yeah.
Colin, see you soon.
See you soon,
and
thank you so much. Thank
you
so much, and the same to you, man.
I want to introduce you to Clodagh Dunlop. Good morning, Clodagh.
Morning, Ryan.
And thank you for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Your story is quite something. So let's get down to business, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Give us a flavour, Clodagh, if you would, of your life up until what happened happened. That is to say, about 4 years ago, what were you doing for a living and how were things going generally?
I was a fit, active, frontline police officer up in Derry. I absolutely loved life. I ran 4.5 miles every day and enjoyed travelling the world.
What age were you?
35.
And were you in a relationship or were you single or what was happening there?
I had a partner of 2 years and we enjoyed travelling. We had just finished travelling for 6 weeks around Africa, living out of a tent.
So you were at the extra active end of active.
At that time I enjoyed jumping out of an aeroplane, skydiving. I was an adrenaline junkie.
And life as a police officer in the service there, were you enjoying your job or was it stressful? How was it for you, broadly speaking?
Do you know, I love my job. Frontline policing is interesting and it's challenging at times, but I absolutely loved my role.
And your partner was in the same business?
He was, yes.
So that probably helped a little bit too, I suppose, at the end of a long day. And then let's go down, get to the point where, if you don't mind, you over the course of a few weeks or months, you suffered from a series of what?
I took a few mini strokes in early April 2015.
Yeah.
I attended AME and they were misdiagnosed as fatigue. And I accepted that diagnosis because I worked long hours as a police officer. But ultimately then on the 6th of April 2015, a clot dislodged from the vertebral artery in my neck and travelled up into my brainstem where it became stuck and stopped the flow of blood to my brain. And I had a major stroke and woke up in intensive care with locked-in syndrome.
Good Lord. I mean, so this is what they call a brainstem stroke, I understand.
Yes.
And when you woke up, can you bring us inside your head, Clodagh, for a moment? Because none of us that I know of, I don't know anyone who has had locked-in syndrome. But can you give us a sense of your eyes open, you're there, what are you seeing or thinking or feeling?
Your eyes open and it's initially surreal. I'm relieved that I'm alive. I query, where am I? Because it's intensive care is like a spaceship or it's a movie set almost, and you establish where you are. And there was a part of me was relieved that I had been right, that there was something wrong with me, but my body was gripped by pain and then I became terrified. I wanted to scream out for help, but nothing would move. I couldn't make a sound. And simply it was harrowing. I was more helpless than a newborn baby. I couldn't kick out. I couldn't scream. There were tubes incubating me, breathing for me. My tongue was pressed on my teeth, wires coming from both my arms, and I could hear people talking and walking past, and there was simply nothing that I could do.
I can't imagine. You were completely conscious of your surroundings, of who was coming in to see you, what they were saying, all of that?
Yep, completely conscious. I was. Imagine yourself as you are now,
yes,
just being unable to move, unable to make a sound. So if you're uncomfortable, if you've an itch or you've a pain, that you can simply do nothing about it.
And when people came in to see you then, Clodagh, were they aware that you were conscious and compos mentis?
Not initially,
really?
No. On that first day, I was wheeled for CT scans and nurses were going about their job and no one talked to me. Everyone was talking over me. But it was when my partner visited me and he looked directly at me and he asked me, Clodagh, are you there? If you are, can you blink once for yes? And that was terrifying because I knew that nothing in my body moved. I had no control over anything. I knew my eyes had been open from I was awake, but I didn't know if I had any control over my eyelids. And that moment I thought, I can't get this wrong. I need to be able to blink. And I remember concentrating really hard to close my eyes and then open them as wide as I could. And I was so relieved whenever my partner told me, you're going to be okay, Claude. I knew you were there.
It almost has to feel. It feels to me that so you were like, almost kidnapped by your own body, and you were trying to make communication with the outside world by hook or by crook.
I often say it's like I felt like an astronaut detached from their spaceship, drifting off into the solar system, screaming out for help in the world beneath me, but no one could hear me, and I was alone.
You talk about the humiliation, at least the initial humiliation and frustration. What sort of things did you find unbearable, in a sense?
I'd gone from being a front active, frontline police officer, and I was a young woman at 35 years of age, and I remember finding it really shocking, and I guess illness is humbling when I'd woken intensive care and you were given bed baths and I wore an adult nappy, and just you became very aware of your nakedness when you would feel the cold fat on you and people washing you, and that was shocking for me, and I had no control over it. As a woman, I was upset that I had no control over my choice of bedwear. Couldn't choose my pyjamas.
What did they put you in?
I remember when I woke in intensive care being horrified. I was wearing a nightdress. I thought, my mother has sent this and it must be a new nightdress, belonged to my grandmother.
Okay, as if the other humiliations weren't enough, is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It was like, oh, where did this nightdress come from?
Could you cry?
My sister often described my cries as the most painful thing she ever had to watch. I had a silent cry, simply my mouth might have opened a little and the tears would roll down my face, but I made no sound and no other movement. And my tears would sting my eyes and tears would roll down my face behind my neck, and crying almost became a form of torture for myself.
Because of the pain of it?
The discomfort of it.
Yes.
If you can imagine, when you have tears in your eyes, you instinctively wipe your eyes. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't lift a hand to do that. And I was lying in a bed, unable to adjust my position or my head. So when my tears rolled down my face, they would roll down behind your neck. And there was nothing I could do to wipe them. And it's surprising just how irritating your own tears can be when they roll down behind your ear.
I can imagine, as if it wasn't bad enough in the first instance. You mentioned your sister Diane there, and she was a godsend because, and I think anyone who spent any period of time in hospital will know the importance of the dignity of the everyday things that a man or a woman wants in life, and she did that.
She was brilliant. She knew that, like any young woman, I would be worried about how my eyebrows looked and how my hair was and were my legs shaved, and she would attend hospital and pluck my eyebrows and shave my legs and make sure that my hair was okay and that I was happy with it. Bizarrely, when you're locked in, you still have a little bit of vanity wondering, how do I look to the outside world?
Well, I don't think it's vanity. I think you're entitled to that little bit of self-respect, I suppose. Let me ask you about Adrian. He did something very interesting that you described there a few minutes ago, which was, Clodagh, this idea of him arriving into the hospital, everyone talking over you like you were kind of barely not there. And he looked you in the eye and said, are you in there? You described the difficulty, but the need to get that blink down. Did you then develop a communication through blinking with him?
We developed a system of blinks. So it was one blink for yes, two blinks for no, three blinks for I love you, and four blinks for you're a moron.
How often was the four blink technique required?
I think I used it a lot, but people chose to ignore it. But I always say, if you can imagine in a day, if all you could say was yes, no, I love you and you're a moron, how much would go unsaid? And you're at the mercy of everybody around you asking you the right closed questions. So there is nothing further you can communicate. You can't say, I'm hot, I'm uncomfortable.
You were 6 weeks with locked-in syndrome, a syndrome that I've never heard of anyone coming out of. And yet you made this very peculiar sound one day that I think took you by surprise. Could you describe that to me, for me?
My best friend had been not very good at using the spell board, and in my frustration at her, I wanted to scream at her, and suddenly from nowhere I made a sound somewhat like a dying pig, she would say. For me, that was the best sound ever.
And that came out, isn't it just as well your best friend was useless at the board?
It really was.
Strangely.
Sometimes I'm so grateful that she frustrated me so much, because I wonder if she hadn't have, where would I be now?
Yeah. Yeah. And how do we go from that awful guttural sound to coming out of locked in, to be unlocked?
It was the first indication that maybe I might, you know, recover. And that was, it was enough for me to keep working at it. So every day I would lie in my hospital bed, simply staring at the ceiling, unable to move, continuously making that sound like a dying pig, because I knew I want to talk again. It's horrific and horrendous how vulnerable just you are when you can't communicate or indicate to anyone what's wrong with you. And I would lie all day making strange noises, and nurses initially would come running and offer to help and ask what's wrong, but suddenly, slowly everybody realised, no, she's trying to talk again. And it was really, it's really been a long process, learning to talk again, retraining all my mouth muscles, my swallow.
But it took about 7 months altogether?
Do you know, it took longer than that. I was in hospital for 7.5 months, and I was just discharged from hospital, taking steps, and I could talk, but I wasn't completely intelligible. Mm-hmm. And the steps I were taking, if you'd touch me with a finger, I would have fallen over, and it was thought at that time I would be in an electric wheelchair forever. But when I got home, I worked at it every day for hours on my recovery, and I would watch television and sing and talk, and talking became an obsession to improve my speech.
For all of that endeavour to get better, there was this very dark moment where you were just, I think you were having a rough time with Adrian. You hated the fact that he was your carer, and he came home and found you one day doing what?
When I was discharged from hospital, I had lived for that moment for 7.5 months to get home from hospital. Yeah. And Adrian had worked for it too. You know, we'd worked so hard to get me home. And maybe there was a little part of us naive where we didn't fully appreciate life wouldn't be as it was before. Once I got home, I'd gone from having physiotherapy, speech and language therapy all day, every day, and nurses caring for me, to just being Adrian. And simply everything, he had to do everything, and everything he did irritated me. He didn't squeeze the tea bags right. If he helped me put on my shoes, they weren't quite on right. When he made the bed, it wasn't made just quite how I liked it, and I worried that I wasn't going to get any better. And I'd felt so low that at that time I wondered, would I be better off dead?
And you took it a step further than wondering, didn't you?
I did, but thankfully he came along and found me, and it was a moment where I think both of us were really honest with each other, where I had said, you know, I didn't want to live like this. And Adrian was always very good, very logical. And as he said to me, Clodagh, you know this isn't going to get better overnight. You need to work at it. And he's been a real source of strength for me. And when I've been low, he's been very realistic, and he knows that I respond well to common sense.
And what a response you've made. Can you put a little bit of your life in context for us this morning, please, Clodagh? What have you been doing since all of this desperate experience?
I would always say that life is richer now. I am back at work full time as a detective in the police service of Northern Ireland.
Amazing.
And I have an adapted trike and I enjoy cycling. Yes, I can't run 4.5 miles anymore, but life is richer. I enjoy my friendships, my family, relationships with people much more. And it's funny, you're talking about kindness on the show before. I would say that I'm a kinder person now, and I understand that when people maybe aren't receptive or grumpy with you, that they perhaps have their own troubles, and we don't know what's going through anybody's head in a day. So I'm always pleasant and nice and offer everyone a smile.
Isn't it terrible that it took that experience in some ways? I'm not judging you, Clodagh, but for all of us, it takes a terrible experience sometimes for us to realise actually it's a much nicer and easier position default-wise to be a bit kinder.
Do you know, it has really taught me to appreciate the small things in life.
Sure.
You know, I had no control over my arms, so I couldn't brush my own hair. And now I enjoy, I can do my own hair. I can brush my own teeth. You know, just simply to be able to scratch an itch. I can decide what station I want to listen to on the radio. When you're lying in intensive care or in the stroke ward, or when you're locked in, you have absolutely no control over your environment. So I wasn't like an ordinary patient where I could flick through a magazine, I could choose what television program to watch. And I just appreciate my environment so much more. And I would say that I really appreciate Ireland so much more. I went skydiving on my year anniversary from taking the stroke, because dinner didn't seem really to be an appropriate thing to mark the occasion. You almost died. And when I got, well, when I was hurtled out of a Cessna plane and was descending down over the province, I was like, it blew me away just how beautiful the green checkered fields were. And I don't think I fully appreciated how beautiful our country was until I had a stroke.
I find your story remarkable, Clodagh. I'm so happy for you and for Adrian, and that you came out the other
Thank
side.
You.
It's absolutely a knockout story. And the lessons you've learned, you're teaching us a lot of things this morning, and opening my eyes, no doubt about it. I can't wish you enough happiness in your life, and have a lovely Christmas
thank
with you and your
Ryan,
family.
Thank you, Ryan. Same to you.
Really nice to talk to you today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you so much. Clodagh Dunlop joining us on the programme this morning. She's written a book about her experience, and it features photographs also of her and in hospital in the middle of it all, and then out the other side, the strength, both emotional, moral and physical, is extraordinary. It's called A Return to Duty. That can be bought online at beatinglockedin.com and, of course, in Waterstones. So that was quite the story, was it not? It's 3 minutes to ten. Well, one of the most critically acclaimed writers and performers of a generation, Phoebe Waller-Bridge's refreshing, original, deeply entertaining comedy Fleabag became an instant international hit when it debuted in 2016. It's a series about a dry-witted woman, known only as Fleabag, who has no filter as she navigates life and love in London while trying to cope with all sorts of extracurricular activities. And we just can't get enough of this programme. And though Phoebe insists it's done and dusted, fans can get their hands on Fleabag, The Scriptures, which contains the complete filming scripts and never-before-seen stage directions from this series. And with a mantelpiece now cluttered with Emmys, BAFTAs and every other award of note, Phoebe has just been named the most powerful person in television. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, good morning and welcome to the programme.
Good morning, thank you.
Crikey, the most powerful person in television. Where are you? Is that humbling or heartening or harrowing?
It just sounds like I'm armed, doesn't it?
Sounds like you should be arrested.
Yeah.
Tell me what that a moniker like that does to you.
or for you?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It all feels, that kind of thing feels, I mean, it's lovely to hear that. I always think it's quite hard to sort of believe that sort of thing, because I don't really know what it means, but it's lovely. And you, it's, yes, it's, you know, humbling, empowering, all the things that you said.
Are you still in a sort of pinch me mode in terms of your success, or have you kind of got over that bit?
I think I'm in some ways in total denial of that kind of side of it, because when I'm working on it, I mean, so I'm just under a duvet or on the set or sort of in a car at 6 o'clock in the morning on the way to work. So, and that's most of the time we're doing that. And so when these kind of explosions happen, when something goes well, it just feels like this kind of whirlwind and sort of not entirely real. So it's a constant pinching moment, but also just constantly saying like, oh, it's a bit silly, isn't it?
And do you have a sufficient amount of real friends, the ones that you probably count on one hand, to keep everything in order in terms of brain and ego and expectations?
No, I ditched all them.
Good.
When I got my Emmys. Yeah.
So you're now surrounded by fake.
Yeah, dead to me. Dead to me. Yeah, I just like the people who agree with me.
Yes.
And who tell me I look fabulous when I look horrendous. No, I do. I have a really good set of friends who, you know, keep me grounded.
the wing and, clippers.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of them are the people that I made the show with, you know, so it's we're all kind of becoming arseholes together.
Of course. And successfully with it, you know, that's what's quite nice. Congratulations on the success, as I say, on Fleabag. And obviously in season two, we on this island watched with a greater level of interest, because one of our favourite sons, Andrew Scott, played such a key role as the priest. We'll get to the H word in a minute, but the priest certainly. He brought something special to the programme. Were you friends, or tell me about Andrew's involvement in the whole proceedings?
Yeah, we met 10 years ago when we did a play together at the Soho Theatre in London, and we were playing traders in a play called Roaring Trade, and it was one of my first ever jobs, and I was completely blown away by him as an actor and as a person. He's just the most kind and lovely, generous person, and then this extraordinarily charismatic and talented actor, and I was just so desperate to work with him again. And and you know, I could say, you know, part of me thinks, I wonder if my whole writing career has just been me building up to writing something for Andrew so we can hang out again. And when I was coming up with a character for the priest, you know, I thought there were so many traps I could fall into with kind of comedy priest or sitcom priest, and I really wanted him to have a kind of complexity and integrity. And the moment I thought of Andrew in the role, I couldn't get him out of my head, and I write about it in the book that I go and I have a coffee with him, and I explain the whole storyline and sort of beg him to be in it, and we spent hours talking about it. And he actually took me to the Quaker Hall in which is featured in the show. He took me there the first time that we met, and I was so sort of moved by the experience, I ended up putting it in the show. So he's given so much to this show, and I mean, I couldn't be a bigger fan of his.
And there's a great chemistry between the two of you on screen. Obviously, that's something that comes from a shared love of comedy and similar probably personality traits. But he's great. He's casually profane, loves to drink too much. Was he a difficult subject to create? Or, you know, I was just curious to know where you went for that one.
Well, I met a monk called Father William, who... And we met once and we spoke on the phone quite a few times. And that was the insight that I desperately needed, because I needed to speak to a priest, and he'd been a priest for many years before. I needed to speak to a priest who was also completely owned the fact that he was also a man and a human, and was vulnerable with me when talking to me about it. Mm-hmm. And that was an incredible insight, because he said some things that just, you know, just expanded my brain in terms of what it means to have faith, but also just really broke my heart as well in terms of things that he doesn't consider sacrifices, but things I would consider sacrifices. And we talked about celibacy, which is something I've never thought I'd have an opportunity to talk to a priest about, sex, you know. And so I was very, very lucky with his contributions. And then sort of talking to Andrew, so, you know, in such detail about this character and what he wanted to bring to it as well. And I was just so lucky with the people that everyone wanted it to be a vulnerable character. And I really wanted him to be a good man, because there's so much cynicism around, you know, the Catholic Church and around priests and all that sort of thing. And I actually think that the basic principles of that faith are good and to be kind. And I thought that was something the show really needed as well.
There was hardly an article when the season two came out in the British papers, broadsheets mostly, all talking about the hot priest, hence the H word. They just was one after another. He became this phenomenon, be it in online or in the papers. But were you surprised by that, or had you seen it and said, oh, this is going to be a thing?
When we were filming episode 5 and Andrew whips open the curtain at the confessional scene and I saw the playback of that on the day, I was like, oh, I think we might be in trouble. Because it just felt like this kind of iconic Darcy moment, the look on his face and him just looking so rugged and handsome. And I remember thinking then, I think he may be eaten alive by the public after that moment. And I, you know, I've known Andrew for so long and I've always thought, you know, he's, like I said before, he's just so charismatic, incredibly sexy man. And but so much of that is to do with his openness and his heart and his wit. And knowing that my challenge was to try and bring all that to this character, the way that, and so that Andrew could play all those things. I knew that if we could capture even a thimble of what Andrew had in real life in this character, then we'd have everyone screaming for more.
Some night over gin and tonic, ask him about the porridge ad.
No, wait. The porridge ad when he was a kid.
Yes.
And he, yes. I've seen it.
You've seen it. Oh God, I'm so behind. I'm sorry, Phoebe.
No, I love that. Oh. I think
we reunited him with several bags of porridge.
Yes,
night.
And the guy was there. The original.
Yes. Oh, you saw the clip from the show.
Yes, I saw it.
Oh God, help us, the poor
brilliant.
Man. Okay, so you know what the story is there.
There was something about the jumper or something.
Yeah. Flahaven's porridge. Like, I mean, honestly, you could have called him Father O'Flahaven actually after that. But no, yeah. So you know, you're all over it. And I was on an island in the Aran Islands in the west of Ireland over the summer, and I met this wonderful actor who I've always admired, and we got into a brief conversation, her being Fiona Shaw.
Oh,
and the next thing you know, your therapist, or Fleabag's therapist, is looking at Fiona Shaw. Is this somebody that you, well, just from your utterance there, I suspect somebody you wanted to work with?
Yeah, I mean, I worked with her on Killing Eve, and sure. I saw her in Medea years ago, and it was one of those moments in the theatre when I was just, you know, completely, I mean, just the impact that one performance can have on you for the rest of your life. I mean, that was the one for me. And so working with her on Killing Eve, and then I just was extraordinary. And I just felt like if you can get Fiona Shaw in your thing, you have to just do anything possible to make it happen.
Sure.
And this character actually came in quite late, and I called her, and she was filming Killing Eve at the time. Actually, we became, you know, both shows were sort of warring with each other over Fiona, and also this character, you know, to come in for one scene and be that damn iconic. I don't know, only she could do that. And she's just so light. She's just so she's so light touch. It's extraordinary.
It's effortless, I suppose. But you mentioned the Medea there, and you've said in the past about the inspiration for Fleabag. You talked about Sophocles, Euripides, the Greek playwrights, and I think, you know, it's a dim and distant past to go with the classical playwrights like that, and yet sometimes good writing is simply universal throughout time. Is that a fair point?
Yeah, I think the saying that I kept repeating to myself and the team, you know, when I was writing it, was "Go Greek or go home."
Oh no! Did they all get it? I mean, that's
they
pretty.
They all totally get it because it was like we have to go that big.
Okay.
And even if it's not, it has to feel that epic. And that doesn't mean it has to be, you know, like a cast of 10,000 and massive battle scenes. But if it has to feel that epic for the characters themselves. And I have to be able to write it on the wall like it is a kind of Greek tragedy. Like there's a man, you know, grappling with his faith, and there's a woman who doesn't believe she can be loved, and then by the end, you know, decides she never will love or be loved, and by the end she loves somebody she can't have. And you know, it's all got to feel sort of that level of Shakespearean or Greek. And I think that's, as a playwright and as a writer, I think it's our duty to go that epic every time, however small the story is, because I think we want to be taken there as audience members. And it feels so kind of sort of ludicrous saying that about a sitcom, but it's even more important to me that even when you're saying, and it doesn't have to be pretentious, you know, but it's, I think it's just where you reach for. And I knew that I wanted to break people's hearts with this series because it's a sitcom, and I was like, that's the last thing you're expecting. is to have your heart broken. And Andrew really got behind that as well. When I first met him, he was like, that's, you know, when we were talking about the thing, he was like, that's the thing he wants to play. He wants to play love and he wants to break their hearts. And that's that, he wants that to be the thing that sneaks up on us. And so it was so, so wonderful to see the reaction.
How are you coping with the politically correct era that is, it almost sounds pejorative to say politically correct, but you know, it seems to be hyper sense of people quick to be offended and so on. Are you kind of conscious of that when you're writing, or do you say, I don't give a damn what anyone thinks, I'm just going to do this and what happens, happens?
Completely the latter.
Good.
I don't give a damn when I'm writing, and I feel, in fact, I feel really driven by it, because I feel like, again, that's kind of a duty that you have to fly against all that.
Yes.
And also, it's fictional, so you're allowed to. I think and it's important to. I think as long as it's not, as long as there's a reason for it, like, I think people can be behaving badly. And I think that things like gratuitous sex or gratuitous violence, obviously there's a line when it just feels like you're not sure why you're doing that. I think if your story can always justify the actions of your characters or the language that you're using, and if you can really stand by that, then I think it's really important to not give a damn. It's in real life, you know, it's in interviews and stuff where people, when you can just say something quite innocent and then people will, you know, twist it, or I don't know, that's like, real life is far scarier than fictional life.
I was saying to a friend of mine, smart person I work with, I said, what do you think of Fleabag? And they said, at last somebody's got women right. And I said, well, then as a man, as a straight man watching Fleabag, it's giving me an insight into you and what you're probably really thinking. How do you react to my reaction, if I may?
I mean, I love that.
Do you?
I love it, yeah.
Because I'm watching it like a manual.
Good on you.
Yeah, well, I want to learn.
Thanks.
I want to learn. Well,
that's like the best attitude I can imagine. I feel like, in some ways, you know, she's a very specific person, that character. But in other ways, I love that there's a universality about how people talk about her, because to me, she seems so, she seems so relatable.
Yeah.
But then when people are writing about her, you know, when it first came out, when the show first came out, and it was saying it's the filthiest TV show that's been seen in years.
Thank God.
You know, and there's, thank God. And also there's loads of nudity in it and everything. And like, weirdly, there was no nudity in it.
Yeah.
And it was much less filthy than so many kind of male-driven sitcoms when they're just sort of, I don't know, like wanking all the time. Although there's a fair bit of that in Fleabag as well.
There is.
But I think because of the female slant of it, that's kind of, people were sort of shocked by it. Whereas I found, and so many women spoke to me about saying that they actually, related so much to her life. And that everyone's saying she's extremely promiscuous when actually she sleeps with like three people across the series. And it's just because she talks so openly and so candidly about sex. And I suppose that dual personality thing that I think women can relate to, and I think a lot of men can as well, but that the front that you have when you go out into the world, which in Fleabag's case is her lipstick and her trench coat and her hair, and when, if she looks as though she's together, and then she behaves politely to people, and then there's this other side underneath that lives underneath all of us, which is the bit that hides. That says,
yeah, but
this is the real me.
Yeah, isn't that what a human is? I mean, as you said, like, if you scratch away enough, there's more Fleabag in people than anyone gets credit for. But also, that's what's so interesting about the programme, is that since television was created, let alone literature and theatre, we've always had the point of view from just one side of this. And I'm not trying to plumasse or ingratiate. I'm just, it's a matter of fact. And now at last, something like this comes along and you go, oh, right. So they're, the women are as bad as us in terms of naughtiness, in terms of what they really think. It's kind of, it's refreshing, it's reassuring, and it's heartening.
Oh, good. Because we've all known that forever.
Yeah, but they didn't tell us. You kept it to yourselves.
People weren't letting us. Yeah. They weren't letting us say.
The patriarchy didn't want to know. Women think about sex? No, it couldn't possibly be.
Well, exactly. And I think that the enthusiasm from men for the show as well has just been, it's so gratifying, because like you say, it's like, oh, you know, we're all, because I am a strong believer that there is very little differences between the genders. I really, really believe that there is. And I've never felt you know, felt it that. I mean, I've always felt so passionately about that. And so the fact that people, that, you know, that you're saying that to me about the show, because I do feel, you know, I'm never going in thinking I'm going to write an extraordinary woman. Yeah. You know, I just think of a character and think I'm just going to write this person as truthfully as I can. And but I think actually because so much of there's actually so much to play with female characters because of that element of surprise, that it's actually, it's a bit of a gift.
Now, what with the James Bond, how much can you tell us about your involvement in the James Bond script?
I can tell you that I was brought on when the film was already, you know, the story was already there, the characters were already there, and I was there to sort of punch up the script across, you know, all the characters.
Yes.
And I wasn't alone in it. I mean, I can't really take the credit that people seem to be giving me, which is lovely,
co-writing the
script. I wouldn't go as far as that. I came in and helped punch up a few scenes and had a couple of ideas along the way. And, you know, Carrie, the director, is a writer on it as well. And he was writing on it long after I was as well. So there's been many, many people working on it. But it was, my God, it was so much fun. And to be around those sets and that, you know, that cast was just... sort of dreamy, really.
And did Daniel Craig personally draft you in?
He did. So Barbara Broccoli contacted me, and she said that her and Daniel had been talking about it. So I don't know the exact sort of genesis of it all, but I'm I'll just believe it.
Take it all. And given like Killing Eve and your writing of that, and the sort of international espionage and intrigue, are you a Bond woman? Like, were you a Bond fan?
Yeah, I mean, of all the movies, certainly. And I only started reading the books during the film, or like certain passages through the books, and now I want to go back and read all of them, because it's just, that character is just so glorious. And it's easy to forget, I think, because we take him for granted because we've had him for so many years. But actually, I mean, he's just one of the, he's one of the most complicated, funny, sexy, dark, dangerous, and yet family-friendly characters. I mean, how can you encapsulate all those things in a character? I don't know. And he's just, he's glorious.
Fleabag, the scriptures, incidentally, why did you decide to release them like this? Was it a demand thing, or did it just feel right, or was it just so beautiful to read, or what happened?
Well, I was approached by the publishers who said, you know, would you be interested in this? And I've been talking to SEPTA about it for years, the potential of doing this for years. And there was just something so magical about the idea of having it all with this, you know, having people having access to the stage directions and every different aspect of the script, and to see it written down. You also get another insight into, you know, what the actors brought to it. And there's just something really special about having it written down and having the real words there. And it's a complete thing, because for me it's always been this like scattergun of scenes that I've either had on a wall or on post-it notes, or, you know, on like bits of script on set. And so to have it in this beautiful book with, and, you know, I've been able to write about the people who were involved in the making of it as well at the back. And there's just so much in it that you don't sort of see in the show, like little details and stuff. So.
And was this, did I read correctly that you said that this was drawing a line under the Fleabag experience for you? No season three, no doors opening again. It's a good night, good luck.
Yes, yeah. I felt very instinctively that this was the end of her journey. And
you know, Arthur Conan Doyle did that once.
Oh yeah? He tried, did he?
He tried to kill. He threw him off the Reichenbach Falls. And the next thing, he bounced back about 3 years later when he was stuck. So
when he was getting hungry or something. Need another. Yeah, I do have... I've had a sort of fantasy of bringing her back when I'm 50. And bringing the character back when she's 50. Because then I think there's a story, there's a whole life there.
For sure.
But, you know, I felt like at the end of this one, she learned sort of the lesson that hadn't been learned in the first one, and it was a kind of bigger lesson, which is about you know, love. And I don't really like, I feel like the thing that felt most right was when I came up with the idea of her having to leave the camera, or the camera leaving her, which was the debate at the beginning which one it would be. And then, and the moment I knew that she was leaving the camera, I thought there's no coming back, because they're the two main parts, you know.
Well, we will talk again, I've no doubt. Phoebe, thank you so much for your time today. Yeah, I really enjoyed our chat this morning. Phoebe Waller-Bridge's book, Fleabag, The Scriptures, is published by Sceptre and is out now in all good bookshops. The text number, meanwhile, as always, is 51551.